Welcome to The Composer's Voice. It's a co-production of the Minnesota Composers Forum and Minnesota Public Radio. In 1971, Alvin Singleton went to Europe on a Fulbright scholarship. And like a number of American composers in generations past, especially in the years following World War I, he stayed for over a decade. And like Aaron Copland and Virgil Thompson and Walter Piston before him, Alvin Singleton's European sojourn influenced his life and work in some unexpected ways. For Singleton, living and working for years in a place lacking all the natural signs and tags of home tended to force him to look in fresh ways at his own identity as a man and as an American.
I think that every person should be put in a situation where the support system is gone, where your language is different, the customs are different. And at that point, you really define what you are, what it is in my case to be an American, and what that really means in real terms.
I'm Bill Morlock. My co-host is Jeffrey Brooks. Alvin Singleton, who is African American, found his early musical heroes among the jazz players in his Brooklyn neighborhood. He first found classical music when he was in his early 20s. He was attracted by the grand theater of it, by the great spectacle of the orchestra.
The thing that strikes me listening to Alvin Singleton's music is that he obviously just has a terrific ear, and he uses that ear to filter out all but the most intriguing musical events. He doesn't use any systems or formal musical structures. It's more like, for him, to write down a musical composition is like improvising in slow motion. Alvin Singleton likes to listen to all different kinds of music and as often as he can. He considers it part of his job as a composer. And he's brought along some of these pieces that help shape his distinctive approach to music, as well as some of his own compositions. The first music we'll listen to is the opening of Mahler's Second Symphony.
When you had decided to quit your job as an accountant and study music full-time, you got a job as an usher at the New York Philharmonic Concerts. And this was about 1963?
Yeah.
So you were about 23.
Yeah.
And you were... Was this... It probably wasn't the first time you had an orchestral experience, but there was something about listening to the...
Well, actually it was.
Was it?
Because music came to me, you know, very late in my life. And I, where I grew up, my heroes were jazz musicians. I mean, I had a lot of jazz musicians in, living immediately on my street. And I didn't realize how lucky I was that I... These things that I heard for the first time, I heard live. And during that time, Bernstein played a lot of Mahler. And I remember hearing the Mahler Second, and all this being new to me, I went to all rehearsals as well. And I remember Mahler's was so exciting, the Mahler Symphony, the opening with the basses. And then later on, how it builds up, this Resurrection Symphony with this, the soprano and contralto a duet. And then at the end, and there was the chorus and the soprano voice rising above. I said, this is amazing.
When you saw Bernstein, did you think that that all conductors would have these kinds of overtly cathartic experiences on stage? I mean, he was pretty remarkable.
Well, you know, at that time I defined that as particularly American. I mean, you know, here's someone who's a great musician who really doesn't define music in categories as such, you know, based upon his own example as a composer and a creator. And I like that very much. And the fact that he was so physically involved in his performances was also a treat for me. It was honest. It was an honest release, as honest as, you know, a Thelonious Monk would get up in the middle of a session and dance around and then go back to the piano. You know, or in a religious experience, how people move when they speak or when they're delivering sermons or when they sing, and that didn't bother me at all. In fact, it was inspiring. theater. It's theater at its best. And beginning from, you know, just generally speaking, for these very low sounds and this rattling sound, this movement, you know, ending in crowds of people with one voice excelling over it.
You do sound like a concert goer when you say that. I mean, I'm a non-musician, and when I go to a concert, I mean, it's on that level that I listen to things, and I.
Well, it's the same as, you know, when I go to hear performances of my music, just because I wrote the piece, it doesn't mean I know it as a listener. And I'm experiencing that for the first time, sitting out there. Because if you go to rehearsal, you're listening technically. And you say, oh, the balance is here and the balance is that. It's like, I mean, how many times have you heard people who star in movies interviewed and they say they haven't seen the whole film? Mm-hmm. It's because they're so involved in the bits and pieces and they haven't seen it as a whole, as a work of art. And as a composer, I'm experiencing it for the first time. I hearing my piece from, you know, this side of the orchestra. And it's very different. This is Agaru number 7. Agaru is a word from the Twi language. It's spelled TWI. It's a language spoken in Ghana, and it means to play. In an earlier piece, my Yellow Rose Pedal for Orchestra, this happens. There's a little section where there's vibraphone, and the vibraphonist runs a chord and holds the pedal, and it sort of smears it. And it sounds great. I said, oh, that's a good idea. I think I kind of kept that in my subconscious.
You kind of filed that away for future use?
Well, no, I think composers write the same piece their whole lives. And they just wait to, you know, they grow a little each time, and they can, you know, can see it differently each time. I mean, we basically have the same tastes, and, you know, we get more sophisticated, and we strip down a lot of things. You know, at the end of your life, you have fewer clothes, you have your favorite book, as opposed to books, and, you know, everything is stripped down. It's about editing. Yeah, I say growing up is editing. What I often do is I repeat things a lot, to the point that you think that no composer would do this. It must be being made up. It's because that's what people do. They doodle. I don't know. I think it's some kind of a psychological phenomenon, because often I hear something, and then when I hear it again, it gets more and more familiar. Then I want to hear it again. And then I keep wanting to hear it again. And then you reach the point when you don't know how to stop it. Without creating a situation where the structure becomes incoherent at that point. And then when you hear it again, you wonder, well, and then you change. And then you go to something that's completely different. It's unimaginable.
Yeah. And then the non sequitur is more powerful than it would have been
exactly.
Had you not repeated that so
exactly.
many times.
Exactly. I try to capture what improvisation, the spontaneity that comes from improvisation. And so I try to capture from that. I say, what about this is making it alive? And I try to write according to that.
This is Morning Song by alto saxophonist Ornette Coleman, and we'll also be listening to a piece called Snowflakes and Sunshine, in which Coleman plays both the violin and the trumpet.
Well, Ornette Coleman is his main instrument is saxophone, is alto saxophone, and he has this unique sound because his saxophone is, I think, made of a hard plastic. And he had this really unusual raw sound, which is, and the way he plays is so related to singing. It's an extension of singing. I remember when I was young, I used to go hear him play with his quartet with Don Cherry with the pocket trumpet and Billy Higgins on drums. And this is a recording from Sweden, a place called the Golden Circle from Stockholm, on which the piece Snowflakes and Sunshine, he plays violin on here, and he also plays trumpet. One would not, you know, readily think of Ornette Coleman as a violinist or a trumpeter. But what he does is, on here, is so creative. He creates some kind of, it creates a real raw energy.
I'm sure Ornette Coleman got used to certain ideas that he associated with what his fingers did on the saxophone. And you put a strange instrument in, like the violin, that you don't necessarily know how to play in a conventional way. You start finding things that you would never find searching around on a saxophone or
exactly.
A keyboard.
Exactly. I mean, it feeds my imagination. It's so exciting. And, you know, it's the kind of thing a, quote, legitimate composer doesn't do, because in your lessons, you can't do this. And here's someone who is totally uninhibited.
This is an early work by Alvin Singleton, Mestizo II, an improvisatory composition for orchestra.
I did a piece earlier on. It was while I was, you know, still a student. I wrote a piece for orchestra that required improvisation. And one of the problems is that you have a group of musicians that are in a situation where they're taught to read what's in front of them religiously, to just follow instructions, as it were. So in this particular piece, I created a system where everyone could participate. I gave them an interval, one note, say the first note to the seventh note, and in a scale, and the instruction was that they were to play all of the notes within this interval as quickly and as loudly as possible.
Listening to the Ornette Coleman and your orchestra piece back to back, it seems like when Ornette Coleman, you know, gave up the fine pitch control when he picked up the violin and the trumpet. I mean, you lose that pitch control, but all you get is the energy of the player. It's kind of interesting. I was thinking, what would have happened if you would have made your orchestra not play their, made the violins pick up a trumpet or something, if. Maybe they wouldn't be so inhibited as far as the.
Well, but what did happen at the end of this piece? You might want to play the very end of the orchestra piece, where the total orchestra, all these things come back. Now the instruments that cannot be heard, such as bassoon, harp, are instructed to move to the percussion section, and the percussionist hands them shakers and hit sticks, anything that can hit.
So much music in the air that it becomes that you can't hear it anymore. I mean, you can flip the radio. If something doesn't grab you right away, you're gone.
It suggests, you know, getting to know something. And in fact, we forget that music is about ideas, as all arts are, in the relationship and how things are constructed. And the thing is that I've learned to isolate the idea that, you know, that ideas appear in all styles and all forms, and I think one misses out when you only listen to one kind of music or one composer, or I think one has to open up to the world around him or her.
This is popular stuff, but I think we all have some kind of relationship with James Brown, even if we don't know that many pieces, individual pieces.
Yeah, well, you know, it's music that functions. Yeah, basically, it's dance music, but it's message music as well. I mean, he talks about things in everyday lives, and what's always attracted me to James Brown is not only because of the dance as well, but the structure of his music, because he sets his structures, you know, in an improvisatory way, in that when he wants to change to go to another section of the piece, he just says change. He says, hit me,
take it to the bridge.
He's always had one of the most fantastic bands going. I mean, you know, often people think because they play just R&B that they're not good. These are fantastic musicians. I think that in a cold sweat.
Oh. Oh. I don't care about your wants.
It's really neighborhood music. I mean, it's what you would hear, well, at least when I was growing up, mainly on black stations and in African American neighborhoods. And you know, it wouldn't be on the airwaves like the Beatles, for instance. But yet, James Brown was always an idol of all these groups. When you kiss me. You hold me tight, make everything all right. I wake up in a cold sweat. Mazio, come on now.
This is from the Symphony No. 4 by Polish composer Witold Lutosławski.
And you have all these things overlapping in you, Lutosławski. These, I guess, non sequiturs. That summits simultaneously appear. Lutosławski has organized these lines in such a way that they appear at the same time, although individually they're very different in style and in tempo and in color. I mean, you look at this piece and you say, oh, this is amazing. You look at the ingenuity that went into reaching this simplicity, which is what I think beauty in many ways is about, if one can actually define beauty. But one has to know a lot to make things simple.
This is such beautiful music.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. And that's why I always say I like the spontaneity. I like my music to have the spontaneity of a James Brown, but organized like in a way, keeping it all in like Lutosławski does.
I wondered how you were going to find a common thread between James Brown and Lutosławski. You did it.
And then you have all these surprises, not only melodically, but in colors. The colors are amazing. That's why when you go for a while without the benefit of, quote, conventional melody, it doesn't bother you because the colors are so beautiful. I think at that point, if there was a conventional melody, it would be too complex. I mean, it would be confusing, and I think it'd be a waste, actually. Whereas you can like he's playing this melody now. It's very lean. It's just that one line. That's all you need because the melody itself is attractive in the context of the section that we just came from, which I see as being a part of the world of all of these pieces that I brought. I see all of this as a part of, I guess, my world.
This is Shadows by Alvin Singleton. It seems in all of your pieces that there's often some kind of initial really attractive or intriguing sound that you start with that gets the listener's attention right away.
As is in my work Shadows, which begins with one sound, a low E in the orchestra. And a lot of material is built around that, but that E is anchoring everything. I mean, you're hearing things in terms of that E.
There's something very confident, though, about that opening in a way, a big gesture.
Yeah. So one thing I realize, you know, especially as I write more music and I get older, is the simple things that we go back to anyway. I just realized that this one note with a lot of weight in terms of instruments and dynamic level, high dynamic level, was the biggest thing I could come up with. And of course it sets the stage for this long rise, you know, which takes a long time, you know, which is...
Yeah, this is what, about a 22-minute piece?
Yeah.
And it's a piece that unfolds very gradually.
And to have so many overlapping lines, I realized something earlier on, and that was that the lines had to be very simple. Because you can't hear, you couldn't hear anything more complex.
Describing the energy of this piece over the course of 20 minutes, it gradually, you know, gradually the tension just gradually increases and increases and increases throughout the whole piece.
Wouldn't you say that? And also, the tension increases not only alone from the material, but from the repetition of the material. It's that emotional thing that happens, sort of like, you know, it's a tag at the end of a spiritual. To get locked into a repetition where you keep repeating the ending of that, and it gets larger and larger and larger and larger. You anticipate an ending, it doesn't happen. And this last section here, this is something about different. I mean, even I wrote it, but I don't think I did, because when I listened to it, it's so shockingly different. And I didn't know how I came up with this. I have no idea.
It's funny when that little bit of a violin melody comes in there. It's at that point that you realize, oh, we didn't really have a melody. But it's funny, you weren't missing it.
No, but this melody comes from what the violins play when they enter that first section. It's just played at half its speed. I guess in a sense, this is coming from my subconscious from the Mahler second, when it's the soprano above the choir. I don't know. I can't prove that or anything. I mean, I certainly wasn't thinking of that. But I think all that we experience lives with us.
Alvin Singleton says that a composer writes one piece all of his life, changing it, editing it, paring it down to essentials, and therefore, according to Singleton, making it better. This thesis suggests something interesting and extremely hopeful about the creative life. Alvin Singleton is a man who listens to everything. He does his best to see all that he can of other worlds and to read all that he can. He includes, with psychic arms wide open, whatever happens to be out there. Yet his vision in this world of informational overkill is for a creative life of increasing mastery over his material. He will not be overwhelmed by all that is out there. There is the possibility that his artistic life leads, metaphorically, to that one favorite sweater, those two or three favorite books, and one really good E-flat to hang an orchestral piece upon. His vision is hopeful. It chooses a path away from the chaos of a noisy and media-saturated world, and suggests that a good mind and a good imagination can still create a world of meaning and even of peace. Alvin Singleton, our guest for this edition of The Composer's Voice, which is a co-production of the Minnesota Composers Forum and Minnesota Public Radio. The program is produced by Alan Baker with assistance from Elizabeth Schmidt. For Jeffrey Brooks, I'm Bill Morlock.